Next case is United States v. Acevedo. Is the appellant prepared to argue? Is the government prepared? Okay, appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Joshua Fix. Together with Captain Brian Osterhage, we represent Staff Sergeant George Acevedo. The appellant requests to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is it Acevedo?
Acevedo, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
In Chatwin v. United States, the Supreme Court warned that kidnapping is a serious offense and courts should avoid a careless concept of the crime of kidnapping that seek to punish general transgressions of morality. This court, Your Honor, should be guided by that warning to avoid a careless concept of this crime that might be used to punish a general transgression of morality. The elements of the offense of kidnapping by inveiglement are inveiglement, a holding against the will of the victim, and that holding be done willfully and wrongfully. Also, the terminal element, of course, of Article 134 applies. Here, however, the evidence, even in the light most favorable to the government, is simply insufficient to show that the appellant willfully and wrongfully is with intent.
Could you speak up a little?
Of course, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Even in the light most favorable to the government, the evidence here is simply insufficient to show that the appellant intentionally held Ms. A.M. against her will after subjecting her to a trick or deception to lure her astray.
Why wasn't her will overborne by the threats against her? In your brief, you talk about the perception of the victim in this case is really not controlling, but the perception was based on specific statements of the accused saying, either you're going back to base or I'm going to prefer charges against you or make sure that you're reported. She says she interpreted that, and we're looking at this in the light most favorable to the government, as meaning either I have to do what Acevedo tells me to do, or I am going to face charges. Why wasn't that sufficient to address this issue of willfully and wrongfully holding her?
Well, Your Honor, for at least two reasons here. Those statements were made at essentially the outset of this whole event, so they did not take place after the alleged inveiglement.
But what caused her perception that if she did not comply with the demands of the accused, that she would be facing what she perceived to be even worse, and that is some type of disciplinary action?
But and so the specific demand of the accused, Your Honor, with respect to potentially reporting Ms. A.M. for underage drinking, was that she take a cab back to the barracks. She, in fact, got in a cab, and the appellant also got in that cab, gave his address, not the barracks address, which she understood to be his address when he gave it, and she chose to give no other address. So to the extent to which she was told, look, go back to the barracks, or I'm going to report you for underage drinking, that's not consistent with the actions she then took.
So it's your position that it should be multiple frames of this movie should be taken, and we should look at each frame of the film and decide whether somehow the actions of the accused were completely dissipated?
Well, Your Honor, the overall context is important, and please let me know if this is not answering your question, but the overall context is important here. But when viewed in the overall context, you also have these explicit statements by the appellant that he was suggesting she still could go back to barracks. And that was specifically after they had both gotten out of the cab at his residence. He asked her what she understood would happen if they proceeded to go into his residence.
So what if it were a more traditional kidnapping and someone forces somebody into a vehicle, transports them 2 miles, and then says, hey, you want to come in or not? And the victim's feeling is, if I don't do this, he's going to do something evil to me. Are you saying that because 2 miles later in this cab ride, that there was some ability for the victim to exercise some type of choice, that that means that the kidnapping didn't already occur?
Well, Your Honor, in the context here, not necessarily. So first of all, in Your Honor's hypothetical, perhaps that could support a charge of kidnapping, because you would actually have a physical holding that is part and parcel with the kidnapping itself.
Well, she's sitting in a moving car. That's kind of a physical holding. Well, I mean, I suppose she could open the door and fall out on the road and take the consequences. But I follow up to Judge Olson. Are you saying that because they had this exchange or whatever, that somehow that it immunizes everything that took place thereafter? He says, you're going to get in trouble if you don't go back to the base or come with me. And she says, yikes, because, you know, that means I got to go through whatever course I'm going through again, than which there is nothing worse in the world, as anyone who's ever served in the armed forces knows. So she gets in a car. Assuming her will is overborne at the time, whether she's inveigled or basically shoved in the car, you know, now she's in a moving car. Sounds to me like she's held, that her will doesn't have much to do with it.
Well, except in this scenario, Your Honor, it's not simply a moving car. It's a taxi cab, and there is a taxi driver.
Right, and the point is that she could have said, driver, take me to DLI. Don't take me to this clown's apartment. But she didn't.
Correct, Your Honor. She
okay,
did not.
And that's your argument.
Well, in part,
yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
It's the agency of Ms. A.M. matters here. The fact that she had meaningful choices matters here. This is not a situation where as soon as somebody is lured into a vehicle, they have lost meaningful choice because they do not control the vehicle. This is not like the situation in Blocker, to be very specific, where as soon as somebody is in a vehicle driven by their assailant, they no longer have meaningful choice over where that vehicle is going, what they're doing. And in Blocker, what the PFC Blocker in that case wound up doing was then physically holding and violently sexually assaulting the victim in that case. Here, however, you don't have that scenario, Your Honor. What you have is Ms. A.M. in a taxi cab, understanding that directions have just been given to the appellant's residence, and with every opportunity to actually request that the taxi also go to DLI, and she chooses not to take that opportunity. That is correct, Your Honor.
You don't think that has anything to do with her state of mind?
It certainly probably does have something to do with her state of mind, Your Honor, but it doesn't show the intent to hold someone against their will. The holding against the will is, if it is a mental holding, it is a mental holding that is akin to a physical holding, a force so profound that the victim does not have any meaningful free choice here.
But, counsel, this is a legal sufficiency case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so are you prepared to say that the member couldn't have found that because of the rank and the threats and the situation that she didn't feel that way?
It's not that she didn't feel that way, Your Honor. It's that, and she in fact testified that she did feel that way, But it's more, there's another component than the subjective feelings of the alleged victim here. The intent of the appellant matters. And here, there is no apparent intent to hold against the will in any way akin to a physical binding or holding.
Well, he made threats about her getting in trouble, right? And then the cab left.
If she did not go to back to basically her barracks, Your Honor.
Right, and that's got her in the cab.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then did he take her back to the barracks?
Well, he gave his own address, Your Honor, which she understood to be his address.
If she has some sort of duty, to say, no, driver, don't go there, go here. I mean, she's gotten in the cab. He's already pulled rank on her. He's already threatened her with punishment. And now what you're saying is that by remaining quiet in the face of all this, that negates whatever he did.
Well, it demonstrates that he had no reason.
Or at the very least, it says it's not beyond a reasonable doubt.
It shows that it is.
Well, what is it? What is it?
So faced with these facts, Your Honor, a reasonable fact finder could not determine that the appellant intended to hold her against her will beyond a reasonable doubt, because everything that Ms. A.M. testifies to is about her own subjective experience, not about anything she did to indicate she didn't, in fact, want to be doing this.
Her subjective experience is, here's this staff sergeant, which is an E what, 6?
E6, Your Honor.
Yeah, E6. She's an E2. And she's at 19 and she's drinking. He's already caught her. And he's already threatened her with discipline. And I just have a hard time taking that fact situation and saying that her will wasn't overborne.
Well, and it's not simply whether or not her will was subjectively overborne, Your Honor. It is the question of whether or not he intended to overbear her will in a way that is akin to a physical holding. And here,
well, if he didn't, why'd he give his address and not DLI?
Well, for any number of reasons, Your Honor, one would be he expected her to give DLI and didn't develop a belief to the contrary until she...
He expected her to just stay in the car? Is that what you're saying?
But either... So it is a common practice to share cabs, Your Honor.
Right, okay. That's what... That could have been what he's doing.
But the issue here is that when it became obvious she was not going back to DLI... He had no reason to believe that was because she felt that she had no choice. In fact, he asked her whether or not she was okay with what was transpiring and suggested that she still had a choice near the end of the whole of the evening before they entered his apartment.
But JA-35 has her testifying, quote, I was afraid that if I didn't do what he wanted, there would be some sort of retaliation against me, end quote.
And again, Your Honor, that goes to her subjective belief.
But it was based on his statements. Quote, I saw her drinking. If she doesn't get in the cab and go back to base, I'm going to report her for drinking. Statements to the boyfriend that she had to take a taxi back to her post or she was going to get into trouble. So this was not just something subjective. Getting to the point that Judge Ryan made about the standard here, we're looking at a situation of legal sufficiency, and she wasn't just grabbing these concepts out of thin air. She was basing this on the statements of the accused.
Well, and Your Honor, if this were charged differently, then certainly there may be some meat on that bone, so to speak. But what you have here is not a situation where this was charged as, for example, like a sexual assault by placing someone in fear or something like that. You have a kidnapping charge, and you have a kidnapping charge where you must first have inveiglement and then have a holding, and that holding, if it's not a physical holding, is something that is akin to a physical holding. And what we simply don't have is any demonstration of the intent of the appellant to commit a holding akin to a physical holding after the alleged inveiglement here.
So do you concede that there was inveiglement?
We do not concede that, Your Honor. However, the appellant's argument is focusing on the intent aspect as the stronger argument. However, there is a good question as to exactly what the alleged inveiglement here is. There are, honestly, a couple, and I see, Your Honor, my time has expired. If
I'm you can finish the question. I think Judge Sparks
has. I did have one question.
And I have one after that, Mayor.
Okay. Go ahead.
So to finish answering Judge Olson's question, Your Honor, the appellant does not concede inveiglement. However, the government's theory seems a little vague as to what the inveiglement is, because it then raises separate questions about where you can show a holding after the alleged inveiglement.
Judge Sparks.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, you had mentioned that there's no evidence of his intent. Aren't the accused words at the end of the cab ride some indication? He doesn't just say, are you okay with this? As I read the record and remember it, I thought he said was, you know what's going to happen now, don't you? That was the first statement he made, I thought, when they got out of the cab. Am I incorrect in that?
In part, Your Honor, but then...
In part I'm correct or in part I'm not correct? Or both?
So you are correct that he said that, but then when she said yes, he asked her to clarify, and crucially, and I'm looking for the joint appendix site here, on joint appendix 54, this is in the cross-examination, after her explanation of what she believed was going to happen, which was a sexual encounter, he then asks, are you okay with this? If you're not, just go back and get in the cab and leave. And Ms. A.M. agrees that that is what he followed up that statement.
Well, earlier you mentioned that this is all taken in complete context. You have to take the whole context. Isn't the context in which she's now acceding to this request colored by everything that went on before?
It is colored by everything that went on before, Your Honor. However, the intent to hold her against her will is still not demonstrated under these facts in this case.
Okay.
Counsel, as I understand your argument that what this court has to do is determine objectively whether the facts establish an intent here, not necessarily whether there are words that say expressly, I'm holding you, or a physical act that I'm holding you, but that there can be, and you're arguing that they're not, objective facts which could constitute a holding as a matter of law.
That is accurate,
okay.
Your Honor.
And secondly, as part of your argument, you've focused on the question of points at which that is rebutted by her opportunities to exercise choice. As I saw the record, there was only one incident, one aspect of this in which that choice, opportunity for choice, was expressed, and that was when the taxi arrived and he offered her the opportunity to go back at that point. Was there any other point where the choice was made express in a manner that would diminish whatever else the court might look at in terms of objective facts of intent?
That is the place where he expressly asked her whether or not this was what she wanted.
Right. I understand your argument that there were opportunities at other point, but was it ever expressly stated at any other point that there was an opportunity?
That is the only express point,
okay.
Your Honor.
So at that point, the government has argued in its brief that PV2AM could no longer see the cab and no one had told it to wait. So the question of whether there was a choice, when he gave her that choice, the government contends that the record shows PV2AM could no longer see the cab and no one had told it to wait. Why couldn't the fact finder in this case determine that that was sufficient evidence to show that there wasn't a real choice at that point and there was a holding against will?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, again, it is not the holding itself or her subjective belief therein, but his intent.
I'm not talking about the subjective belief. At that point, looking objectively, is there evidence in the record which shows that that was not a real choice because the taxi had left? Is that statement in the record accurate that the government has cited there?
It's accurate that they were out of view of the cab, but the clear implication of the statement as it's made, Your Honor, is that at least the appellant believed the cab to still be there. There's no evidence that it wasn't there. They were out of view of the cab, and they had not told the cab to wait.
That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may please the court. I am Captain Sandra Ahinga, and along with Captain Austin Fenwick, I represent the government. This court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case because the facts are legally sufficient for the charge of kidnapping by inveiglement. First, appellant had the necessary intent to willfully and wrongfully inveigle and hold the victim. And second, appellant did in fact inveigle the victim into a taxi cab under false pretenses and hold her against her will.
Every single sexual offense that required it to be against her will.
Yes, Your Honor. So the findings for not of not not necessarily, Your Honor. The article, we can only speculate as to how the panel came to those Article 120 findings, but certainly they were two very different crimes, and the victim is making decisions under a very different context. Right? So. In front of at the bottom of dark stairs, in front of the appellant's door, interacting with an NCO in a way she's never interacted with him before, she's making very different decisions than she did, than she might have in front of the bar, walking to the cab stand and getting into the cab. So two very different contexts. She is fully isolated at that point. And there are very different defenses available to the Article 120 as well. So that finding is very separate from the finding of completed crime of kidnapping by inveiglement, which is completed by the point that appellant gets into the vehicle, Your Honor.
I raise that because kidnapping is like one of the original felonies, right? Kidnapping?
Yes, Your Honor.
Serious felony, punishable by death, life imprisonment in some jurisdictions. And I'm just concerned now that we're going to start seeing that as the final charge on every sexual assault case.
Yes, Your Honor. Here we do have that completed offense, and what we might see as well, Your Honor, is essentially the panel saw that as a completed offense when the appellant gets into the vehicle. They understood that she was making very different decisions of the apartment at that point.
Okay. Then the government's position is, he inveigled her into the cab.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that she was held by virtue of being in the cab for some amount of time, even if he gave her the opportunity to leave once they got out of the cab. Is that the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So the government's position is basically that whatever happened sexually happened after the kidnapping.
Yes, Your Honor, and she's making decisions based on that new context.
She's right, or the new context is whatever it is. Okay, but that for some period when she was in the car, and the choice presumably was either yell at the cab driver, open the car door, and fall out on the street. That she was being held against her will.
Yes, sir. And as Your Honor points out, she has no legal responsibility to report, to try to escape. And at that point, we see it even in the interaction in front of the bar, her will had been overborne at that point. The appellant uses his military authority the threat of disciplinary action and the specter of physical force to overcome the victim's will, even way back in front of the bar. That umbrella carries over.
Then is it really kidnapping by inveiglement, or is it kidnapping by force?
It's kidnapping by inveiglement, Your Honor.
He inveigled her in the sense that something bad's going to happen to you if you don't get in the car. That doesn't sound like inveiglement. Inveiglement to me sounds like something good's going to happen if you get in the car. Or am I wrong?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the inveiglement is the choices that the appellant gives her in front of the bar. When he's met with resistance and telling
Well, it doesn't appear that the appellant is really pushing the inveiglement anyway. So, you know, if we, for whatever. Anyway, she's in the car.
Yes,
and, Your Honor. And then she's held for some period during which, you know, the only two things she can do is yell at the cab driver. I suppose she could yell at the appellant, but that didn't seem to do much. Or jump out of a moving vehicle.
Yes, Your Honor. And okay. Certainly the appellant at that point knows that all of that, everything that's happening is against her will, because she has vehemently objected in front of the bar and says, I don't want to go with
you. I understand what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor. She says, I don't want to go with you. I want to go with my date. Starts to cry when things escalate and, you know, the specter of physical force is applied. So all of those things tell the appellant, if he reveals what he actually intends to do, that he will meet with resistance from her, necessitating the inveiglement at that point. So the only reason that she is walking is that inveiglement, Your Honor. And we do hear, as to the issue of holding against her will, the entire encounter, so in that moment,
I thought the inveiglement was that he said he was taking her back to base, and he didn't.
Yeah, yes,
but
Your Honor.
She went with him thinking he was taking her one place, and he took her another place.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And I thought that the rank issue and the threat issue went to her being forced, it being against her will.
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
Counsel, then is it the government's position that if after the cab ride ended, she had taken out a cell phone, called another cab, and gone home, this would still be the same offense?
Yes, Your Honor. The offense is completed
at that,
the moment
at that
the
time.
Appellant gets into the vehicle and detains her. Right. So he immediately gets into the vehicle. There's no hesitation. He grabs her. As the door closes, he grabs her by the hand and pulls her close, which is essentially a physical manifestation of that detention at that point, a reminder that he controls all of that situation, everything that's happening from in front of the bar into that cab and all the way back to his apartment. And that's where that detention is manifested.
And is there any case you can point to us where, either in the military justice system or elsewhere, that has constituted the offense of kidnapping, when there's been, in situations like this, basically a short cab ride, and then a person leaves, or any kind of short ride, and there's no physical interaction after that? Is there any other precedent we could look at to say that's in the absence of that context that you would get from the follow-on activity, it is kidnapping?
So, no, Your Honor, not as to the cab ride necessarily, but we do see United States v. Jeffers, which is cited, that even a movement of 15 feet is enough to qualify. Right? So,
but is Jeffers a case in which there's no follow-on activity?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Is Jeffers a case in which there's no follow-on activity?
So here we do have a situation where it's against her will, and again, that holding against her will happens the minute that the appellant gets into that vehicle. Door closes, he's holding her hand, he's saying his own address. What we don't see, and a reasonable fact finder could find, he doesn't turn at any point to the victim and say, what is your address? Is it okay if you if we go to my place first and then have the cab drop you off? He knows from the minute he's in front of the bar that he is taking her home to have sex. He's detaining her in that car, reminding her by pulling her close, engaging the cab driver so as to And a reasonable fact finder could find so as to engage the cab driver and not give her an opportunity to give her own address or perhaps report it.
So then are you relying on the after activities to give a context to demonstrate the elements of the offense? Are they relevant to this case in terms of determining whether all the elements are met for purposes of legal sufficiency?
Only to the extent that they manifest the appellant's intent to take her home from the bar to have sex with her. We see that intent, you know, manifest in the moment that he gets in without hesitation and says his own address and doesn't sort of engage her in the normal conversation of sharing a cab and saying, do you have money? Is this okay if we do this a particular way? But those facts back at the home, the sex themselves, a reasonable fact finder could have inferred backwards all the way to in front of the bar to say that was his intent from the beginning. And we see all of that, the isolating her from her date, walking her between himself and Sergeant Benavides, who was there with him, and taking her all the way to the cab, ensuring that she gets all the way in before he reveals to her where they're actually going. And at that point, in the moment that she tells us that she was in shock, trying to understand why exactly this was going on, that's when he gives his address, that's when he's pulling her close and reminding her that he's in control of that situation, Your Honor. And it is telling that appellant is choosing to kind of make that reveal about where it is that they're actually going in the moment that he's placing his hands on her for a second time. So initially we saw him place his hands on her back at the bar to when he's overcoming her date's will to take her home and her own date or her own will to go home. A reasonable fact finder could find that this act was less about, the act of holding her was less about, you know, conveying an interest in her and more about a reminder that he, you know, he's the one controlling everything. And she's already seen essentially the response to any sort of resistance, right? She did vehemently resist in front of the bar and say she didn't want to go, and how that was met with placing touching her and pulling her back, getting in the face of her date, a person who was significantly larger than the appellant. That may not go to, you know, the appellant's state of mind, but it does go to our victim's perception of what, you know, that specter of physical force, of what he might do if she does not comply. So the Supreme Court tells us in Chapman v. United States that the act of holding does include a mental restraint for an appreciable period against the will and the intent of the victim. Here we do see that again in the entire walk to the cab, and then in the cab when he's, you know, holding her close, saying his own address, and essentially not engaging her in conversation. She at no point understands or believes that, you know, her report or any fighting will not be met with significant resistance. And again, that specter of disciplinary action is overbearing her will at that point.
Counsel, does it bother you at all that in Chapman, given the factual circumstances of that case, that the Supreme Court nonetheless found that there was no mental coercion in that case? Does that give you any pause? I mean, they certainly were a bit more extreme than what we see in this case. Would you not agree?
Your Honor, if I remember correctly, that was a situation where the 15-year-old girl had had chosen to enter that cult.
Enter the cult, right? I mean, after she was, like, mentally told by these older people again and again and again that was the only way for salvation.
From the opinion itself, Your Honor, I can't tell exactly how her will is overborne. But at that point, she did make that choice to enter into that celestial marriage. And that's essentially what...
A 15-year-old with a 68-year-old? Or however old you are?
Yes, Your Honor. And that was part of the issue in Chatwin was to say whether or not she had the mental capacity to make that choice, and court did find that she could, and she did make that choice, and it was not against her will at that point. But here, we do have the victim saying vehemently, I do not want to go with you. This is against my will. We see that will overborne in front of the bar, and again, just as he's getting into the vehicle with that reminder of holding her hand and pulling her close, that it is appellant's will and not hers that will govern where that vehicle is going. So despite the fact that there is a driver here, the overall driver of that vehicle was the appellant, and he was the one controlling that situation.
Counsel, could you address the military context of these discussions and how it might differ from just a number of people being in a bar? Is there something about the military context that focuses on the issue of holding against the will, overbearing the will?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly what we have here is a 19-year-old PV2 who is standing in front of two NCOs that are, from even what the victim tells us, are well-respected, or at least appellant was well-respected in her unit. They are making a very sort of adamant and aggressive order to her, and she's just out of AIT, just arrived, and that umbrella of military authority, despite the fact that she's not directly under his control, sort of colors everything about her decision-making as well. So at Joint Appendix 28, she does actually tell us, I believed them, right? So it goes to the embezzlement as well. I believed them. I respected them for wanting to take care of me, right? So that's the only reason she's walking with them at 2 o'clock in the morning to a cab stand, because if not, she would have made the decision to go with her date, and that's what she wanted to do. But because these NCOs were trying to take care of her, in her mind, right? She's embezzled at that point, that sort of colored her decision to go with them. And at that point, if she were in the cab to be deciding whether or not she's going to flight or tuck and roll out of the cab, she's also facing disciplinary action throughout the entire encounter, right? That specter of disciplinary action never ceases. That threat is always there. So she's making those decisions in that context.
And you've addressed it several times at points, what was in her mind and what she believed. Are we looking at her subjective belief at this point, or are there circumstances that would make these objective matters that a fact finder could rely on for proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, Your Honor. Here, in the light most favorable to the government, the standard or for legal sufficiency, in the light most favorable to the government, whether a reasonable fact finder could find all of the essential elements beyond a reasonable doubt, we do have that here, Your Honor. We do have manifestations of what she thought and what appellant thought, right?
But is it simply what she thought or what objectively would be viewed as something that members could rely on the circumstance? Now, I think that's part of what the defense has been arguing, is that her subjective thoughts are not what's important here.
Even if the standard is objective, Your Honor, we do have facts here that help us understand objectively that it was against her will, and the appellant understood what he was doing throughout the night and intended to do so. From the interaction at the bar, the appellant had to have understood, and a reasonable fact finder could find, that she did not want to go with him. And it's interesting, or it is telling, that he does not choose to reveal to her exactly where they're going until the last possible minute that she's sitting in the vehicle, completely isolated. Sergeant Benavides has now closed the door and is gone. There are essentially no other options but to sit in that vehicle and go wherever it's going. The physical manifestation of the holding, we do have that here, the grabbing her, the holding her close. We do have a manifestation of his intent all from his question in front of the door, you know what's about to happen. He's known what's about to happen from all the way in front of the bar to that moment in front of the door. So even objectively, Your Honor, I think a reasonable fact finder could have found all of the essential elements here beyond a reasonable doubt. Yeah, pending any further questions, this court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case because the facts are legally sufficient to establish kidnapping by invasion.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
So, Your Honor, the government has just argued that the kidnapping was complete at the moment that the appellant got in the vehicle.
Got out of the vehicle, right? Well, whatever.
My understanding was that it was from the moment the appellant got in the vehicle is the government's position. If that is the case, then kidnapping by inveiglement is not the right charge here. Because at the moment that the appellant gets in the vehicle, Ms. A.M. is exactly where she believed she would be with exactly the choice, the set of options that she believed she would have there, possibly with one option added, and that is to go back to the appellant's residence rather than DLI. And the Ms. A.M.'s choices matter here. And if she has meaningful choices, to include some that may be unappetizing but not unlawful, then she is in a position to exercise her own free will over where she is and what she is doing. And at every turn here, she has had choices, some of them being unappetizing, like the question of whether or not to risk being reported for underage drinking or take a cab. Some of them are not particularly offensive choices. Give her address or don't give her address to the cab driver.
Counsel, could you explain why an unappetizing choice is a meaningful choice?
Because, Your Honor, in order to be kidnapping, choice must be constrained in a manner akin to physical force. It's not enough that you're told something minor and negative will happen. For example, the example has been given by some of my colleagues that junior officers in the military are frequently given strong encouragement to attend unit holiday functions. And they may be told that not attending unit holiday functions might have a detrimental impact on the public perception of their service as officers. And so it would be in their best interest to attend. I don't think anyone would meaningfully suggest that attending a unit holiday function a young officer has no desire to be at and frankly would like to be doing anything else than is kidnapping, however. It may be to that individual an unappetizing choice, but it is nonetheless a choice. Now, certainly here, the choice offered is less appetizing even than that, having the potential for misconduct to be reported. But it is still a choice. It is not an unlawful choice.
So if at a holiday party an officer suggests to a junior enlisted person that their career would be furthered or not furthered by an opportunity to accompany that officer in a cab to his or her house, is that the same or a different case?
Well, it's a different case, Your Honor, but that's also not kidnapping. That may be another offense, and perhaps the government could have and should have charged another offense here, but it's a different offense. It is a military-specific offense, not the ancient crime of kidnapping. And so that's what really cuts to the heart of this case.
But it's written that way in the manual, right? It doesn't have to, no need for ransom, no need for any purpose at all, it says. Right? The holding can be for no reason.
That's correct, Your Honor. But it is still referencing back to the federal law of kidnapping and the historic law of kidnapping. And so while the holding could be for any reason or no reason, a reason certainly helps to establish the intent of the party who's doing the holding. And it also, if it's a holding for no reason, that means that it has to be a meaningful holding. And where the alleged victim has meaningful choices, though some of them unappetizing choices, as Ms. A.M. did here,
There was a purpose here, wasn't there? There was a holding for purposes of having sex.
Well, I see my time is...
Please answer the question.
Your Honor, so the purpose to convince somebody that it would be a somehow a mutually agreeable experience to have sex is not it's not an unlawful purpose, and it's also a meaningful choice.
Well, a mutually agreeable experience or protect your career by having sex with me.
Although that was never spoken, Your Honor, and it certainly was the subjective belief as expressed by Ms. A.M.
But as I understand the government says it's all irrelevant because the curtain dropped no later than when they got out of the cab, and the sex happened later. So who cares? Isn't that the government's position?
But my understanding of the government's position, Your Honor, is that the curtain dropped at the moment he entered the cab.
Well,
but
certainly no later than when she got out of the cab.
And at that point, again, she still had these meaningful choices about...
Well, but she had meaningful choices then, but it doesn't matter because the holding is accomplished.
Well, only if it is sufficient to... it is akin to a physical hold, Your Honor. And here it's the appellant's position that it simply is not. Not from an objective perspective and not in the mind of the appellant.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do you have an opinion about the temporal aspect of the holding? I mean, I understand that you don't concede that there was a holding and you don't concede that it was his intent to hold. But so I'm not asking for a concession on either of those points. I'm asking you a very limited question about the temporal period, whether it was enough time.
It's... Honestly, Your Honor, I'm uncertain if I understand the government's position correctly that the crime was accomplished at the moment the appellant entered the cab. I don't understand when the holding occurred, and so the answer would be no. It is not of sufficient time. It was de minimis, if at all. Similarly, with respect to the cab ride itself, particularly because there is the continued ability to give further directions to the cab driver, whatever holding occurred there would be a de minimis holding.
May I follow? In terms of the crime being completed at the entering of the cab, does the charge itself or has the government argued that that's the end? Is it possible under this case for the members to, for the fact finder to have concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that the kidnapping happened at a subsequent time inside the cab or immediately upon departure of the cab? That is there something that precludes it either in the face of the charge or the argument that the government has made either at trial or on appeal?
The government's arguments are not binding on the panel because the panel is separately instructed, Your Honor. However, they are instructive because if that is the government's strongest position, then it is the appellant's position that the government's strongest argument fails.
I understand that. But if the fact finder could have found beyond a reasonable doubt, and I'm not asking you to concede this, that the kidnapping occurred at some other point, then as I take your answer, there's nothing in the charge itself or in the manner in which the instructions were given that preclude a finding in that regard.
No, Your Honor. The charge and the instructions are broader than just leading up to the cab ride, at least in theory, at least potentially.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides, and we will be in recess until 09:30 tomorrow.